streaming on the web since 1996, this is Cinematic Sound.
Hello again, I'm Jason Drury, and welcome to part two of my interview with legendary music engineer and producer Bruce Botnick, whom I had the privilege of talking to in August 2019 as part of the continuing series of film, TV and video game composer interviews on Cinematic Sound Radio, and to celebrate the year of the 90th anniversary of the birth of the great Jerry Goldsmith. Part one of his three-part interview, Bruce talked about how he got into the film music industry, his work with some of the major bands of the 60s and 70s, his first meeting with Jerry Goldsmith and working with John Williams on two of his most iconic scores, E.T. and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. In part two, we talk about the troubled recording sessions of Total Recall, his work on Basic Instinct, and working on Jerry's final film scores right up to his death in 2004. And during the show, you'll be also hearing music from these films, amongst many others. But first, I continued the interview with this question. Now, Bruce, let's go back now to 1985, where you were the music recording consultant on Rambo First Blood Part 2, brought in by the producers to oversee the work of your now good friend, Mike Ross Trevor. Now, in my interview with Mike, we heard his side of the story. Now, how did you end up consulting on the score, and how much work did you do on Rambo First Blood Part 2?
Well, Jerry wanted me to come over to do Rambo, El Rambo 2. And he said, "You're going to love this guy, Mike Trevor. I enjoy working with him, but, you know, we got to get this score nailed." It was pretty complicated. There were a lot of electronics. There was a lot going on at Whitfield Street. So I remember, because I actually have not listened to all of Mike's description of what happened, but I remember mixing all the electronics while he was mixing the orchestra. And we did all this live. And I think we had a side desk to the left of the Neve desk that I was doing the electronics. I could be totally wrong. And then I can't remember whether we mixed it, the final mix there, or we did it in L.A. Because I remember mixing a bunch of music for that film. The funny thing is, when I saw the film originally, before we went to Whitfield Street, I saw it at a screening in L.A. I saw the movie the way that Jerry used to like to see the movie, is without any temp score. He didn't want to be influenced about where the director thought music should be, you know, and what kind of music. So I saw the movie without the score, just like Jerry did. And I came out, and Andy says, "How did you like it? How did you like it?" I said, "I'm angry." And he said, "Good." And the movie made me angry in the right way, you know. So I don't remember a whole lot about First Blood Part 2, but It was a good score. It was a good movie. It was a rousing score. And I seem to remember, like usual, we did it really, really fast.
I think I remember that you also worked on the end title song for the first Blood film, It's a Long Road, performed by Dan Hill.
That I brought in the group Toto to do the track. They did the backing track, and then we brought him in, did the vocal, and the rest is history. But I remember on part two, I did a song with Sly Stone's brother. I brought in an arranger named Nick DeCaro, who did a lot of arranging, like for Andy Williams and other things, and he was really a great arranger. And Jerry didn't want to do that, so I got Nick to do it, and we kept telling him, I want Chicago. He didn't give me Chicago on the date. Jerry was going crazy. What do you mean? You're supposed to get Chicago. But Andy Vanya was happy, so that was all that mattered.
Remember the
Now, in the mid to late 80s, Jerry Goldsmith recorded some of his scores in Hungary, mostly recorded by Mike Ross Trevor. Were you involved in any way in the Hungarian sessions?
Yes, I was. At the time, the Russians were still there, and I flew over with Andy, got in ahead of Jerry coming and ahead of Mike Ross, who was going to record the score, and went to the studio and basically went through the studio from top to bottom to make sure that it would work. Aligned the studio loudspeakers, got them set up so that Mike could come in and open the faders on the book console and hear music and pretty well trust what he was hearing. The control was done by this acoustician, Tom Hidley, who did the Record Plant Studios and was also part of TTG Studios in Hollywood, where I recorded the Doors' Waiting for the Sun album. He had done that, and he had his loudspeakers and everything, so I set it up and got it right. And when Jerry arrived, Ken Hall arrived, Mike hadn't arrived yet, and we had a couple of days of just eating food and dodging Russian soldiers. Actually, the Russian soldiers were cute. I mean, they were about to leave Hungary, and I remember walking down this little road, and I hear, psst, psst, American, psst, American. And I go over, and there was a Russian soldier with jeans on wanting American dollars for caviar. I only did the one setup, and I was basically an insurance policy. I stayed through the first day of recording to make sure that everything was okay and came home. I don't know how many films that they did. I know that when it came time to do Total Recall, which was also for Carrico, and the push was to do it there, and Jerry didn't want to do it there. And then they said, well, let's go to Munich. He didn't want to do that either, but he agreed to do it.
Bruce, we come to Total Recall, one of the most troubled productions, I think, of any score in Jerry Goldsmith's career, but turned out to be one of his most memorable. What memories do you have working on Total Recall?
My memories of doing Total Recall are quite vivid. We went there, and the stage was actually not bad. It was a good room, a large studio. The control room was up high, and they had a desk, and they had a Sony 48 track that they had brought in from the UK. And we set about trying to record the score. And Paul Verhoeven was there. 2.5 days, we got basically through the main title. It took us that long. And Jerry was beside himself, you know, because he's used to what happened is we used to get to in the UK or in the States, getting 20 minutes a day of music. We're talking about 2 minutes and 30 seconds over a period of 2.5 days. They could barely play. And if we had had the symphony orchestra, the radio orchestra there, we would have been okay. I'm sure of it, because I've heard them play. So that weekend, we were going to take time off. Jerry and I were going to fly to Berlin because the wall was coming down. On Friday, there was a very long and loud phone call from Munich to Hollywood. And, I mean, down to the point where we have to get out of here. We're not getting anywhere. And Paul Verhoeven saying, I'll put up the money if we need to go. And basically got Mario Cassar, the co-owner of Carolco, to agree. So Jerry and I couldn't go to Berlin. Instead, we got on the plane, myself and Kenny Hall, and went to London and set up that night. The next morning, recorded 20 minutes of music. Thank you. It was just like that. That's what happened. It was wonderful. I don't regret what happened in Munich. It was okay.
It's, for me, one of the most complicated scores to perform for any orchestra, and it needed the expertise of the great National Philharmonic to give it the justice it thoroughly deserved.
Well, you know, that's what's very interesting is that I, throughout my relationship with Jerry, I kept saying to him, Jerry, when are you going to write a symphony already? I mean, you got it. And, you know, there's the big scene in Total Recall where he runs through the underground and breaks through that X-ray screen and all that, and then winds up getting on the train and getting away. Well, that in itself, when we recorded it, and Jerry stood behind me when we did the playback, he puts his hand on my shoulder and he says, a movement for my symphony.
That was Clever Girl, Johnny Cab, and A Jump from the 1990 Paul Verhoeven-directed film Total Recall, which starred Arnold Schwarzenegger, with music composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith, performed by the National Philharmonic Orchestra, and in my opinion, not just one of Jerry's greatest scores, but one of the greatest scores ever composed for film. And a complete contrast to Jerry's next project, the Fred Skepsi-directed spy drama The Russia House, which starred Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Oh, yeah. We did that in L.A. That was really interesting. We had the instrument, the Russian instrument, the Dudek. The Dudek player probably was Russian or from the Ukraine or somewhere in there. He came into the studio and he was wearing this long tan overcoat, almost a raincoat, a top coat with a hat. And he sat down in his chair and he pulled out his instrument and he just sat there. Immovable object. And then Jerry would point at him and go, play. Because they had kind of agreed on some light things that he should play, because he really wasn't playing any of the melodies that Branford Marcellus, soprano saxophone player, was playing. But everybody in the orchestra absolutely loved it because it brought such flavor to the score, and you felt like you were there in Russia, if you were have any Russian ancestry. Jerry always wanted to do a jazz-influenced score. I mean, beyond his big band stuff that he did in the early 60s, using Mike Lang and Branford Marcellus, and I should have written down his name, the bass player. It was wonderful, really wonderful score.
Thank you.
That was Bon Voyage, and before that, an excerpt from Conversations from the 1990 score for the Roger House, music composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith, and recorded by my guest today, Bruce Botnick. I'm Jason Drury. Now, Bruce, 1992, Jerry worked again with the Total Recall director Paul Verhoeven on Basic Instinct. It was also recorded at Michael Ross Trevor's studio, which at the time was called the Hit Factory, with the National Philharmonic. Now, to me, this score has a very deliberate, grimy feel in the recording that suits the film absolutely perfectly. Was this something that Jerry wanted for the sound of the score?
Well, the sound of the score is what the orchestra can put into it, is what you're hearing. There was no deliberate attempt on my part to try and put it into a place that was more sexual. It just was. I mean, this was Jerry's porno film, he used to say, because, I mean, it was very, very, very sexual, this movie. Emotionally, I mean, still today to listen to it, it's just so evocative. And you got to understand also, Jerry grew up in Los Angeles during when film noir was real. Los Angeles really was that way. I mean, I remember as a child going to downtown LA and just smelling the air and looking at the light and the buildings and everything, and it was film noir. So he brought that into Chinatown. He brought it into Basic Instinct. The relationship that Jerry had with Paul Verhoeven was very, very special. In fact, he had that with all the directors, where he got to know them and they got to know him, so that they had a way of speaking to one another on an emotional level. And because Jerry was always trying to emotionally tell the story of the character rather than describe the scene. But he was always more interested in what the character was going through intellectually and emotionally. And so the score on Basic Instinct truly reflects the emotional state of these characters, which was pretty out of it. It was fantastic because we can usually tell how score is and how much the orchestra is into it, because they would always want to, after a take, to come in and as many as could fit in the control room or out on the stage, and we'd play the take back to watch it. And so they got influenced by what they saw, and so they were emotionally a part of it. Jerry had that ability to get the musicians involved in the music and what was behind it, like nobody else that I've ever been with.
That was An Unending Story and the end credits to the 1992 film Basic Instinct, directed by Paul Verhoeven and starring Michael Douglas and Sharon Stone, with music composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith and performed by the National Philharmonic Orchestra and recorded by my guest today, Bruce Botnick. And this score to me, Bruce, is another example of Jerry's wonderful ability to create film scores which you don't need to see the visuals to understand what is happening on screen. And Jerry had a wonderful ability to achieve that in his music.
Thank you. Thank you. It's like when I was a child, I used to listen to the music from Fantasia, Disney's Fantasia, The Rite of Spring. Even though it was edited, I would listen and I saw the dinosaurs.
Now, a number of film music collectors and reviewers have noticed in time a change in the Goldsmith sound later in his career, a much wider and reverb-heavy sound. Was this deliberate?
When I've gone back to revisit some of the scores from that era, Jerry was wanting more air and more space in the sound. And in some of the scores, I think we went a little bit too far with the reverb. Most of them we didn't. But we found on the dubbing stages that sometimes the dubbing mixer who was doing the music would be adding reverb to the score, oddly enough, and could never understand why. I mean, what we did was perfect. What did they want to add to it for? You know, they felt that it needed it. And I actually found later on when I was dubbing as well that adding reverb at low levels when you're playing the music really low under dialogue, that adding a little reverb allowed the music to work better with the dialogue and not fight it. And you could kind of just feather it down there and it would float a little bit, depending, you know, what kind of music it was. So Jerry and I would talk about that, and I'd say that I think there's too much reverb. And he'd go, no, I want more reverb. I want more reverb. Okay. But I mean, it's the music in his head. I mean, he said to me one day on a date, I said to him, I said, you're hearing what you imagined, you know, what you wrote on the paper. He said, it come out the way you thought. He says, I already heard it when I wrote it. In his head. So basically what I was doing was realizing what he had and taking it to the next level.
I always thought that Jerry Goldsmith was one of the greatest composers of scoring under dialogue. He always knew the right instruments, the right orchestration to compose under important dialogue in a film, which I feel these days is a dying art in film music.
Well, he liked to write for the negative space. In other words, not to get in the way. And he found a way to do it so that his music would always play. You know, I remember when the beginning of SDDS, which was five loudspeakers in the front and two in the back, the head of the studio at Sony Pictures, Mike Kohut, asked me to remix the last reel for Total Recall in that format. So I was able to spread the music out. And Jerry heard it, and it was like the first time we could really compete with the explosions, because music was coming out of seven loudspeakers. And it wasn't a matter of how loud, it was how transparent it was. It was very nice.
Now, you've usually worked in Los Angeles, recording the scores at the scoring stages there, and mainly finishing the editing process at your studios at Pacific Post. But you've also recorded many of Jerry Goldsmith's scores in London, including Basic Instinct, Total Recall, etc. Do you enjoy working in the UK?
Yes, very much enjoyed working in the UK. I had merged with a video post facility, and I had a company called Digital Magnetics, which was the first digital audio editing and rental company in the United States. And then I was doing all these scores with Jerry. And so that just, we built a dubbing stage at Pacific Ocean Post, and I was able to mix some of the scores there. But recording in London is very interesting, because my first time was when Whitfield Street was actually CBS Studios. It was built by CBS Columbia Records. And I produced a group called Mark Almond, and we recorded it there. We started at the Manor out in Oxfordshire and then finished up at CBS, and it was great. Years later, Jerry's telling me all about this really wonderful, smallish stage that he liked to record in, you know, not going to Abbey Road. And he said, oh, you got to go to Whitfield Street. We're going to go there and we're going to make some great music. And I went, oh, good. And then I go pull up in front of it and I go, hey, it's CBS. You know, I didn't know that this had happened because it was CBS and then the Hit Factory and then Whitfield Street Studios. The loss of Whitfield Street Studios is one of the great terrible things that's ever happened in recording studio history. That was a terrific room. And the people there were lovely. And Mike Ross was there. He was, you know, that was his place. And he was very kind and sharing to me. Interloper from the United States. And it was lucky that somebody in Parliament, I don't know who fought it, got Parliament to agree to allow people like me into the country to mix with without having work permits. And so that enabled me to come over there and do quite a few movies and a lot of stuff at Whitfield, a lot at Air Lyndhurst. I remember bringing over Disney to do all the large choir at the stage at Lyndhurst for The Hunchback of Notre Dame because I was doing all their animated musicals with Alan Menken. Mm-hmm. And we never recorded any music, I mean, any scores there, but I did use Lyndhurst to do the musical Beauty and the Beast, produced that there and recorded it there. I mean, those the rooms over there, and especially Abbey Road, where we did Hollow Man, and we did a bunch of scores there. But the, you know, the thing that impressed me so much about recording it in the UK is the second engineers there. They're all products of the Tone Meister School and great musicians. Same thing at Lyndhurst. It's like this group of guys and gals that are really top drawer. I would come back here and I loved working with my musicians here. I love the stages here, but I really missed those second engineers because they were so on top of it. They would sit down, we'd run the click track and two guys would sit there with the score and they would take every other bar and they would count the bars and they would write it and we would write time code numbers so that at any point in time, we need to go from bar 63 with a pickup, you know, at bar 61 to get us in. Boom, he knew exactly where to go. I mean, they were spectacular. And I remember doing Jerry's solo album that we did with a live chorus and all, and they brought in an electronic pipe organ. This is at Abbey Road. The gentleman that was to play the organ got hung up and couldn't get there on time. And one of the A2s, he just went out there, sight read it, bam, nailed it. It was just like, wow. I mean, these guys are great musicians. So people don't forget. They think that the light shines on me and the composer, but it's really the people that are supporting it all that make it happen, because without them, we'd be a loss. We'll be right back.
That was Fireworks, a celebration of Los Angeles from the 2002 release of Jerry Goldsmith's classical recordings, Jerry Goldsmith Crisis Apollo, conducted by Jerry Goldsmith and performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, and recorded a mix by my guest today, Bruce Botnick. My name is Jason Drury. Now, in the early 2000s, with Jerry's health deteriorating, he preferred to record his scores in L.A. Do you have any memories of working on Jerry's last film scores?
Well, with Jerry's health deteriorating, of course, we weren't traveling to the U.K. anymore because he needed to be close to home and family and doctors. And his favorite place in the universe was to be on the stage making music with his friends in the orchestra. And, I mean, the orchestra honored him in L.A. at one point with a dinner. I think it's the only time it's ever been done. And they made hats and T-shirts for everybody with a fake ponytail on it that said, "You are one of us," which was emotionally a very heavy thing to do because they didn't look at him as this guy up there waving his arm and screaming at the orchestra. He loved them, and they loved him back. He saw the end was near. It's like Jim Morrison's great statement, "The future is uncertain and the end is always near." And truly, you know, at this point in time, the future was certain and the end was near. When we did Looney Tunes, you know, that was it. And he was in pain. It was interfering with his ability to do what he loved to do. I mean, that's where John Debney was brought in to fill up the last two or three cues of the film. That was a very emotional thing when Jerry, at this date, said, "I can't do anymore. I got to go home." And he did that. And I went and visited him about a week before he passed. And he was his irascible self, wonderful irascible self, you know, and that was it. Thank you.
Can you remember what you said to Jerry?
No, probably just tell him I loved him, and you know that I how much he meant to me and still does. I mean, the Egyptians have this wonderful saying that when somebody physically departs, if you say their name, they still live. And so, you know, you say Jerry Goldsmith, or I can say Tommy La Puma, or I can say Tutti Camerata, or on and on and on. Those people still live within me. They're still a part of me. They're not gone. You know, I just don't have the ability to have any conversations or make music with them anymore. Well, I do. That's not true. Because in the later years of remixing the scores and for extended albums, I'm still working with Jerry, which is great. And in fact, I just did one. I did U.S. Marshals. And that's a really, really good score. And in fact, you want to hear a really good score of his for a really terrible movie? The Swarm. Yeah, well, we just did it for the entire score. And so it'll be coming out on La La Land Records sometime in November, I believe.
And with an extract from the cue Never Surrender from the 1995 film First Night, we've come to the end of the second part of my interview with legendary engineer and producer Bruce Botnick. I do hope you have enjoyed what you've heard on both parts of this interview so far. Join us again very soon for the third and final part of my interview. But until then, for me, Jason Drury, is take care and happy listening.
Thank you for listening to Cinematic Sound Radio. I want to thank Tim Burden for providing his voice for all the bumpers and stingers you hear throughout the program, and David Cassina for providing Cinematic Sound Radio's theme music. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please email us at cinematicsound@yahoo.com. You can find us on social media at CinSound Radio on Twitter and Cinematic Sound on Facebook. And if you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please take a moment right now to rate and review the show. It really helps us rise through the ranks and helps potential new listeners find the show. And don't forget to check out Cinematic Sound Radio at cinematicsound.net.